Mother and daughter, breast friends, back again with our podcast today. How you been, Mother?
I've been very well, thank you. What about yourself?
I've not been bad. Just to let you know, FYI, I came across this the other day. Advent calendars have gone on sale.
You are joking me.
No, they've gone on sale. I'm just making you aware that, yes, I do still want one. That, you know, and that is absolutely, you know, just because I am not a day over fabulous and we have those grandchildren things doesn't mean I don't still want an advent calendar.
So grow up.
I'll do it. You know, I can do these beauty ones out there, these all sorts. Anyway, it's nice to be.
Last year I bought you a gin one.
Yeah, the problem was I didn't wait till day 25.
You drank them all on the first day, I think.
I'd run out in the cupboards. So that's what it's all about. So we've been on, we've been a bit on our own different journeys in a way. And we've been doing different things. And you know what's become sort of very clear to me, Mum, is that when we set about sort of doing this, we came up with the idea of doing a podcast. And for me, one of the reasons for it was because I wanted to create memories with you. I wanted us to go and do different experiences. And of course, you know, to tell the story and ultimately as well to raise awareness. Since doing this and since talking to different people, we have become aware of the necessity to raise awareness, to get to that 97% of people that still don't know. I mean, that is just sort of coming out in leaps and bounds. And it's become sort of, I've become very aware of the fact the amount of people that want to be involved in it and the amount of places that this can go, which is amazing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a figure that I didn't actually even believe when I heard that 97% of the population don't realise they've got a BRCA fault or whatever, a high-risk gene fault. To be honest, I couldn't believe it. The amount of publicity that has been done already, and yet that many people are still unaware. It's taken my breath away, to be quite honest. So I realised that all the work that I've done, I've got to quadruple it. So I've made a special appointment with my GP to increase my HRT to be able to cope with the extra workload.
How do you do that? I've only got mine up to 100. I could
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm only on 50, so I've got loads to go. I want it as big as possible. But anyway, there you go.
But no, it is. And it is important. But what is going to be quite wonderful is the amount of different people that we're going to meet. You know, I haven't quite got you to the rave yet, but
You're dead right, you haven't.
There's some things lined up for you. Don't you just worry about that, my friend. And, you know, sort of loads of doors that are opening and people that we can talk to. And also other charities that we can have a chat with, the amazing work that they're doing. When I spoke to Lester from Prevent the other week, I was literally, my mind was just, wow, you know, these guys are amazing and we need to tell people more about what they're doing, but, you know, let's have fun with doing it as well.
Well, absolutely. And you couldn't get anybody more diverse than Julian, quite frankly.
Well, this is what brings us to our next guest. And as we mentioned from the start, for these first sort of few podcasts, it's important for us that we introduce you to people and introduce you to the team that I haven't just sort of worked alongside. I've grown up with a lot of them, but you have worked alongside for many years. And one guy is a guy called Julian Barwell, and I'll never forget the first time I met him, because I very much believe in people's auras or just energy and just being sort of nice people, and Julian gets you straight away, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Julian, I'm sure he'll tell you all this himself, but what he does as well, he gives his spare time in an evening or weekends, bank holidays, to actually ring people on the helpline that have got a medical query that, quite frankly, I can't answer. And I only have to sort of get in touch with Julian, and that's it. He rings them up.
Can I just tell you something as well, which I do, which is very naughty, right? Is I'll see somebody that's probably struggling a little bit, right? And I do tag Julian in it. And do you know what he does? Answers it.
I know.
He's just amazing. So listen, let's not talk about him any further. If I had a round of applause button, I'd do it now. Let's welcome Julian Barwell.
Hi, thank you so much for that introduction. Wow, unbelievable.
No, Julian, we genuinely mean it. You know, we are literally in awe of you because we, you know, we adore the ground that you walk on and obviously the work that you do. So thank you first and foremost.
Can I leave you with this, Becky, for 1 minute? Because this is the doctor about my HRT. I'll be back in 2 minutes. You carry on. Hello.
And ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Off she pops to go and negotiate more HRT. Yeah, go on, out the door. Leave me with Julian.
Be breast aware with Aware. The new breast self-examination aid. Just search Aware Breast Test. Proudly sponsoring the Mother and Daughter Breast of Friends podcast.
This is what comes of doing a podcast. So let's coming back to you, Julian. Now she's left the room for a couple of seconds to go and sort things out. Julian, when I was sort of first introduced to you, it was regarding genomics and the work that you were doing. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. And I want to make sure that within this podcast, not only do we talk technical terms, but we also talk in layman's terms so that people can understand it, because I really believe that that is what's important. So please, can you give us your official title?
Yes. So I am a medical doctor. So I trained down in London, qualified back in 1997. And did all my junior doctor stuff down in London and trained to be a clinical geneticist. So that's a medical doctor who helps people who have got a family history or are affected by a condition that they think potentially runs in families. And my main area is to help people who have got a personal or a wider family history of cancer, and they're worried that that may be inherited and be caused by a gene change that tracks through populations. So my main thing is to help people who have got these family histories. But I also am an honorary professor at the University of Leicester, where I'm trying to help introduce genomic medicine and basically support families to keep them together for longer.
Beautiful. I think that kind of sums it up. So when we're talking about what you do, it's not necessarily just breast cancer or ovarian cancer. It is all types of cancer. Am I right?
That's right. Yes. I also help people who have got a family history of autism or problems with their immune system or the gut and hormonal system as well. But most of my work is in familial cancer, and it looks at really trying to answer why somebody has a family history and try and work out how best to support them, either through screening or trying to prevent them developing the condition, or if they develop a tumor, how can we best target the treatment for that individual to help make sure that they obviously have a good recovery.
Just going back to what you mentioned there, and I hope this will be the case, Julian, that we get you on various amounts of times on this podcast, but the amount of things you cover is huge. And when you talk about the autism side of stuff and then going into the gut, I don't think there's ever been so much awareness as what there is at the moment about gut health, also about the spectrum. Actually,
huge development in this area. We're at a time now where we're starting to think about how best to support people, but holistically. And we're trying to use the similar approaches we've used with the helpline and with support groups like you, thinking not just about the individual with cancer, but we're thinking about their whole family network. And we're trying to apply the same principles to things like autism. So we're looking at things like working with relates for couple relationships, looking at the impact on siblings, looking at the family dynamic, but also looking at educational aspects, wider support for the family, such as disability living allowance, as well as looking at cutting edge research as to how can we actually help that individual with their anxiety or actually improve their cognition, and basically just to try and help the family experience. But thinking very broadly, much more than just trying to say, oh, this child is diagnosed with this genetic condition. We're actually trying to go then and say, well, how do we support that individual? How do we support that family? How do we help their experience in society more broadly?
We could do an entire podcast, and I hope we do, on neurodiversity and the spectrum and understanding it, etc. Also, ultimately, how it affects the menopause, because I've done my research, Julian. I have definitely done my research. So please, if we could do that another time, I would love that.
That would be fantastic. That's amazing that you spotted that there is a link with early menopause and autism. So I'm going to give you a bonus point for that, because that's actually quite impressed.
Thank you so much. I know about the cortisol levels and all of that, Julian. I am there, and it all comes down ultimately as to trying to understand myself and what affects me and how I'm affected and who I am. But again, like I say, I could talk with you on this for hours, and I think we should dedicate an entire podcast on this, because I do find it really interesting, and I do think that ADHD in women, and especially with the onset of the menopause, etc., people are unaware of how things can affect you differently, but actually how amazing it can also be if it's harnessed right.
Fantastic. Love to go into a lot of that detail, and I'll just, as we move on from that, I'll just say there is hope for improved treatments for children with autism, and hopefully that will affect all the A's which go with it, such as additional needs, ADHD, ataxia and tremor, which can be linked to it as well. Yeah. But there are other aspects as well, and I'm sure we'll come back to that. But certainly an area which I think up to now has been unexplored holistically in this type of way. So yes, a really exciting area.
It really is. And you know, as always, I do find you the fountain of all knowledge. And I think ultimately it always comes down, Julian, things always work, and you always embrace your work more when your intention is right. And I think, you know, you are one of these people whose intention has been from the very beginning that you ultimately want to help save lives, you want to help change lives, and we see that in you. You know, thank you, and thank you for everything that you do. Can you just explain to people, because I don't think we've literally explained this yet. We've had a few chats with different people. What is a gene, Julian?
A gene, right? Okay, can I just double check that you can hear me okay, because it's breaking up a little bit from your end. But am I coming through okay?
You're coming through loud and clear, darling.
Excellent. So a gene basically is a code that helps to produce what are called proteins. It's a bit like having a recipe for a cake. It says how many eggs or sugar or flour you need to include, but also in which order does it go and make basically a protein, which is either like a machine, like to help to build and maintain the body, but it's also the infrastructure. These proteins that are produced by these genes are the infrastructure that actually create our bodies themselves. So basically it's a code, like a recipe or a blueprint for the body. And of course our oldest gene is 2 billion years old. I can't believe that it's taken 2 billion years to produce me, and that this is the best it could come up with through evolution. But anyway, 2 billion years. And it's amazing when you sort of blow your mind as to how many times and how much reproduction has gone into making us. But our oldest gene is 2 billion years old.
I don't want to go into the whole kind of, we're all mushrooms, right? And we're all founded by...
We get the chromosomes package all of the genes. They're a bit like having, if you think of genes as being like chapters in a book, then the chromosomes is like the whole book. And the nucleus, which is center of the cell, is a bit like having a library, which has got all the information packed together. And you get a complete set of these chromosomes or books from mum and from dad as well. a faulty gene, not all faults in our gene actually cause problems. So we've all got probably about 400 subtle changes throughout our genome, which can impact in some ways in our genes, but most of them don't cause any particular problems. But there are some changes in genes which can definitely affect the production of the protein and can be associated with an increased risk of disease. Now, most of these genes are quite rare and cause diseases. So there's about 7,000 rare diseases. But inherited breast cancer risk is really quite one of the common ones. And it's normally caused, when it's a strong family history, by a change in only a handful of genes. But lots of different genes can have a small impact in risk. So it's really worth thinking about breast cancer in three ways. You've got these extremely high-risk genes like your BRCA genes. Then you've got genes which have a bit of an effect, and perhaps do things like double the risk, so a gene like CHEK2. And then you've got other genetic traits which only increase the risk maybe by a few percent, 2 or 3% here or there. But if you have a combination of them, it may increase the risk. So it's a little bit like height. So how tall you are depends on what you eat. It depends on how you sleep in childhood, because we know growth hormone comes at night. And it depends on lots of different genes and genetic factors from your parents. So a lot of breast cancer will actually be a little bit like that. It will be partly due to the genes you've got from your parents, but actually a lot of it will be due to a number of different factors, or we just don't know what they are yet. So overall, we know that the really super high risk genes associated with cancer, perhaps one in a hundred people have got something like that. But in terms of the breast cancer genes, if you add them all together, it's probably about one in 200 to one in 300 people have got that sort of very high risk gene change associated with breast cancer. But it's more common in Jewish people, particularly Ashkenazi Jewish people with their ancestry. But by and large, it's about one in 200, 250 who have got that super high risk cancer gene change, which, like unfortunately in your family.
Which is massive, really. Considering as well, we've been talking about that 97% of people that carry a faulty gene at the moment don't know. And and we know that 1 to 200, 1 in 300 people carry this gene. You look at an average town and you think about how many people are wandering around not having that knowledge.
Yes, the majority of people who have got this gene change don't really know about it. And that there's a number of reasons for that. So one is that the criteria for testing is very specific on the NHS. You have to have either a very strong family history, or you have to be affected at a very young age, or have an associated ovarian cancer, for instance. So we know that the current testing will miss at least half of people, even if you come forward and access a genetic test. But lots of people who are eligible for genetic tests either haven't come forward or have been unable to get as far as being able to access a genetic test. And one of the things that we do on the helpline is to try and tell people, if they call up, whether or not we think they might be eligible for a test, and support them to be able to access that. And because it's important to think as to how you frame that discussion with your doctor. So it's a double problem, really. It's being able to recognize that there may be a relevant family history, and that's not always entirely straightforward. And the second one is, even then, and even when you access a test, the criteria means that we are missing a lot of people. So we're still in a situation where most people who have got one of these very high risk genes aren't aware. So one of the very important roles, apart from supporting people through the testing process, is actually to get the message out there that if you've got a family history of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, in some cases even prostate cancer, to actually ask the question, could this be inherited? And in particular, is there a high-risk gene that we could potentially test for?
So we've really, you know, ultimately still got quite a lot of work to do. I've been sat, and one of the things that's been sort of great about doing this is it's given us a chance to look back and reflect and, you know, sort of really take in everything that Mum's done and that you've done and Gareth done over the last 30 years. And as I've been going through the newspaper articles and even looking back at some of this stuff that I've done myself, I think, God, you know, actually we don't breathe it in enough. We don't give ourselves enough chance to sort of go, you know, blooming out, you know, we've done a lot, but ultimately we've still got a lot more to do.
Yes. So there's two or three aspects to that. So one is, well, what happens to somebody who's diagnosed with breast cancer now? And then you've got people who have got a significant family history of breast cancer where testing didn't take place in the past. So for patients diagnosed with cancer now, there's much better systems to try and work out if that individual would be eligible for a genetic test. At the moment, it's mainly on blood, which looks at the genes that have been inherited. But in time, what's happening, and certainly with other types of cancer, like ovarian, for instance, we're actually testing, first of all, the tumor, looking for the gene changes in the tumor and then trying to work out if they're inherited. So for somebody diagnosed with cancer now, there's much better systems in place to try and work out if that individual would be eligible for a genetic test. So for instance, anybody diagnosed under 40 now is eligible for a blood test to look for these very high risk genes. Anybody who's under 45 and got a close relative under 45 as well would be eligible. Or if they've got a hormonal negative cancer, that means negative for estrogen, so they're not taking tamoxifen, negative for Herceptin, anybody with that under 60 would be eligible. Anybody with breast and ovarian together would be eligible. So for people being diagnosed with cancer now, it's getting much better. But the problem is, obviously, most people who have got a family history of breast cancer, actually, their relatives perhaps were diagnosed a few years ago. So for these individuals, there's still a lot of work to be done to work out if genetic testing could take place either on an affected member of the family or potentially even the individual who's worried about their family history. So a lady whose mother and perhaps whose maternal aunt were both diagnosed at 30 and perhaps they sadly passed away a long time ago, they might now be reaching the age of 30 and worried about whether they might carry a gene. And why it's important is if you have one of these genes, then the risk of breast cancer under 50 is a lot higher if you've got one of these very high risk genes. So in the general population, it's only about 2% of women. That's still a lot, but one in 50 women will develop breast cancer under the age of 50. Whereas if you've got a cancer susceptibility gene like BRCA1, then that risk could be as high as 50%. So you go from 2% to 50%. So it's 25-fold more likely to have a very early onset breast cancer if you've got one of these high-risk genes. And that's crucially why it's important to think about genetic testing, because the risks of cancer at a young age are so much higher if you have one of these genes. The good news, of course, is that through preventative surgery or through screening, there's so much that can be done now to support women. And testing is a lot more easy to access if you hit these criteria. It's not perfect, but it is improved.
Yes, I was going to ask you about how do you feel about, I know we keep hearing of new genes being added to the panel and so on for testing. And I don't know whether everywhere does panel testing, do they? Or do they just test for the main high-risk genes? Can you give us any insight onto that, Julian?
Yeah, so I think it depends on what the question's being asked. So, for instance, if there is a gene already in the family, like BRCA1 or BRCA2, then generally it's probably okay just to look for that gene change to see if it's tracking in the family. So that's one side. Then you've got people who have got a very strong family history. Perhaps they've got 4, 5, 6 people affected with breast cancer at an early age and maybe ovarian cancer as well. Then looking for those very high risk genes in the first instance, a reasonable place to go. Now, we do know that there are other types of gene changes which can impact on the level of risk in those families. And it may be that somebody might be high risk, but they might have some protective factors or they might have some additional factors. But apart from those subtle inherited factors, there's all sorts of other tests which are coming in. So these are looking at what's called cell-free DNA. And you may have heard of this, which is called liquid biopsies or a blood test for cancer. And in fact, there's studies going on where you can go into supermarkets and they're doing these studies to try and spot cancer at an early stage in people who don't have symptoms. So there's lots of different types of genetics that's coming along. There's the genes that we've inherited that we're talking about here, gene changes within tumors to try and work out how best to treat tumors. And to target treatment, and that's what I call the Death Star analogy. You can't destroy the Death Star till you've got the plans. But there are also these liquid biopsies, and it's a similar sort of technology for doing gene tests in pregnant women, looking at the DNA that's released from the placenta, and looking for things like Down syndrome as well. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for changes in the DNA actually released into the circulation. So these are changes potentially from the breast tissue, but not inherited. But to answer the question specifically about these additional genetic factors, I think they're going to be extremely helpful in the future for working out who's going to benefit from screening. So in the future, one of the basic principles of genomics is that we treat people for what the disease is, not purely what it looks like down a microscope, because the microscope is obviously several hundred years old and we want to treat disease for what it is from its molecular basis, but also that we screen people based on their risk and not on their age alone. So the majority of women now are screened because they are getting close to turning 50. Another 20 years for you, Becky. The majority of people obviously have got some genetic traits which mean their risk is higher, or that means their risk is lower. Or perhaps they've been on the combined pill for many years, or HRT, or perhaps they had their children very young and they breastfed, which is protective, or perhaps they didn't. So actually, although on average, it's okay to offer screening at the age of 50, we all know that there's no such thing as average. We want to get to a point where we screen people based on their risk.
This is what Lester was talking to me about from Prevent only the other week, which again, I haven't been able to sort of stop telling people in as simple terms as I possibly can, in that now, you know, things have moved on so much that it's almost like bespoke medicine. Am I right in kind of saying that, in that, you know, no one person is the same? So how can we club all these people in the same remit and say, right, yeah, you're going to start at 50, you're going to start at 60. He was telling me exactly the same, that, you know, we're taking all of these risk factors, lifestyle changes, etc., and then be able to say, right, okay, start screening here and have it every so often, etc., etc., and you're not far away from doing that.
It's coming. There's a number of steps. So the first step is to get more uniform testing for people who have got breast cancer and got a strong family history. So how do we get the people that access to testing that need it and are eligible for testing on the criteria? And part of that is to get people with cancer on the front foot and feel supported. So things like this are part of the solution, so that you can say, look, I've had breast cancer. My mum had it. My grandmother had it. I want to be able to access your genetic test. Can we sort that out? So that's phase one, is getting people access to those standard genetic tests when they are eligible. Now, the next phase is, how can we get more tumor testing so that we can treat people with the right drug when they develop cancer? That is very much up and running for ovarian, getting there with breast cancer, there is a little bit further still to go. The third stage is something called pharmacogenetics, which is something we've not talked about yet. So this is the idea of making sure that if somebody needs a drug, they get the right dose and the right type of drug based on how they're likely to respond to it. Because how you break down and use that drug is actually a genetic trait. At the moment, we give everybody the same drug at the same dose. And actually, there are some drugs which are really dangerous for people and will cause side effects. And yet there's other drugs that just won't work for people. And if they're preventative drugs, then that's a disaster.
Yeah.
So, for instance, there's a drug called clopidogrel, which is given to prevent stent-related strokes. We give it to loads of people. It just doesn't work. So the only way you would know is when you have a stroke. So you're taking a drug for prevention, but it's basically useless. Other drugs like statins, for instance, can cause side effects in some people. So statins reduce your cholesterol and reduce the risk of strokes and heart attacks. But some people will have lots of problems with muscle aches and pains, for instance, and lots of people won't take it. But if you knew that you were going to be okay with that, perhaps you'd be more likely to take the drug. So we're working on technology so that when you go in to your pharmacy and you pick up your drug, you'll be able to type in your prescription and it will red, amber, green, red saying don't take that drug, amber, yes, but you need the dose to be changed, or green, it's fine. But we will have two ratings with it. It will have a side effect rating so that you can check how other people with the same genetic profile for you as that drug, how you're going to break down that drug. You'll be able to see how other people, did they get side effects? But also did an effect rating. Did the drug work? So you'll be able to check, let's say, if you need warfarin, a blood thinner, you'll be able to check if it's the right drug for you and if it causes side effects in people who are likely to respond to you in the same way. So it's predictive and it's personalized to you and it's participatory. Just in the same way that you would use an Amazon review or a like on Facebook or a like on eBay, or like if you're picking up a taxi, then you will be able to mark how you got on with that drug based on your genetic profile. So that's the third phase of how do we personalize our healthcare. The fourth phase is when we bring together all this different type of genetic data and we start to think about risk profiling. And you need risk profiling to be able to do that targeted screening that you're talking about. So this will factor in your body mass index, your alcohol intake, your contraceptive history, your HRT history. And if Wendy's just increased her HRT dose, that would go into the system and it would calculate breast cancer risk and how best to manage that risk based on that individual. But that involves us to be able to bring that data together, but also to make sure that we're comfortable with using our data in that type of way. And I think there's a need for a debate around that.
Wow. I mean, it just sounds incredible at the same time as sort of mind, but I can imagine, like you just said, there will be some people that are maybe a little bit scared of that. But ultimately, if we can educate people at the same time, then we can, you know, make people understand why we're doing it and what it's about. I mean, I always think when I go to the doctors, they always used to say to me, I've got the constitution of a hippo. I don't know whether that's trying to tell me I'm fat or what. But, you know, when I used to go for like a contraceptive injection, I used to have to go 3 weeks earlier because it would wear out quicker. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, I always felt like with my HRT, they put me on 25 milligrams to start with. Well, that weren't touching the sides. But that's because I feel like I am a big girl, so to speak. Do you know what I mean? And it does make sense that we're not, again, one size fits all.
Yes. So there's a couple of aspects of that. So one is obviously making sure we give people the right dose based on their size and their body mass index. But the other one, and more crucially, is how you're likely to respond to that drug. Because there are painkillers, for instance, that some people, you give them a dose and it almost knocks them out. And other people, it just doesn't work because their body just doesn't metabolize it. And it's crazy. We'll look back in 20 years and think it was medieval that we gave everybody the same drug at the same dose. And there are lots of times when a doctor will just look at you blankly and shrug the shoulders. And the answer is probably the way in which that drug is being metabolized within the body. So I think there's a lot of mileage there to personalize the way. But the question is, do you want your alcohol intake, Becky, to come from what you say, or do you want it from your Tesco club card and your Visa card? Other cards are available.
Can we move on from that subject, please? And you know, we'll readdress that at a different time. It's like whenever you go into a doctor's and they say, how many units do you drink? And you're like, well, you know, they're 3 or 4 sort of
double
thing.
It,
what,
double
what,
it.
What a week? No, a day. but it, you know, it is right. Ultimately, is what you mentioned sort of way back, you know, and I don't want to keep you for too much longer. And as I say, Julian, you are like the fountain of all knowledge. And I think so many of these things that we've talked about are individual podcasts of themselves, and that's what excites me about doing this, because we're not restrained to doing anything. We can go into as much things as we need to. But you mentioned about you sort of looking into gut health and, you know, sort of risk factors with that. Does a lot of what you've just been talking about come back down to gut health and how you take in these medications, as you were just saying?
There's a lot there that still need to be discovered, I think. So we've talked about inherited risk from these very high risk genes. We've talked about these subtle effects. We've talked about changes in the body and spitting out DNA into the circulation. We've talked about the environment, risk factors, and your body mass index and alcohol. But certainly there is a lot about our relationship with nature. And a lot of that is obviously what we eat and the bacteria, for instance, which gets into our gut. And we all know instinctively how connected we are between our brain and our gut. And I always think that the perfect analogy is not that we live on Earth, that we are Earth.
I love you even more
if
now.
You start to think in that type of context, and you know, we've talked about the fact that our oldest gene is 2 billion years old, and our DNA is a biological clock. It's a bit like when you look up at the stars. If you look at Orion in the night sky, you look at the top left shoulder, there's a exploding star there. And that star, that light is from before Agincourt, just before the Battle of Agincourt. So when you look up at the night sky at Orion, you are looking back just beyond the Battle of Agincourt for the time it's taken for that light to hit you. But your DNA is a biological clock of time as well, which, as I said to you, from a genetic perspective, goes back 2 billion years. And we are all connected through nature. And therefore, you know, only in the last 30 years have we been able to measure that biological clock and look at some of this Darwinian theory. And what we basically have is an inherent link with all living things. And that relationship that you've had with nature over that 2 billion year period, and continually have with all the organisms and with Earth. And it's not that we are living it, we are it.
He's 82% more attractive after that speech.
Well, there's a long way still to go, though, isn't
but
there?
But there is, no, darling, there is. Julian, you are going to be coming back on this podcast. I'll have you back on nearly every day, if that's all right. But, you know, I think, you know, before we sort of say goodbye, because we've been chatting for like the past 40 minutes now, thank you for being in our lives. Thank you for being a part of it. Thank you as well for putting up with me and Mum coming up with bonkers ideas at times.
They are absolutely brilliant. I love them. We had the Jeans Don't Care What You Wear campaign, which looked at the importance of making sure people are aware that jeans can run through the mother's and the father's side of the family. I mean, so many times I've seen people who were told, you know, don't worry about it, it's on your dad's side, for instance. And you know, there's these basic genetic principles we've got to get right. So, you know, thinking about gut health and all these other genetic factors, you know, liquid biopsies or subtle genetic factors and integrated data is fine. But it's important we get the basic message out there, which is, you know, if you've got a family history, come forward and be aware that it can be passed through your mother's or your father's. And if you're struggling and you're not quite getting your head around it, or struggling with your healthcare professionals, to get in touch and we'll try and unpick that with you. And it's an honor, and it's just so great to be working with such passionate people who tackle these difficult subjects so sensitively, but also know how to enjoy life and to really live it. And that's what it's all about. It's, can we get to a point where actually, yeah, you're on top of your family history, but then you can get on and do, you know, the important stuff in life, like having fun and enjoying the arts and all the rest of it. That's what science is for, just to make our life a little bit easier so you can enjoy the other stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I've got to say that my life has just never stopped, really, since I tackled the problems head on. I've just made sure that I've lived every day. Tomorrow isn't promised, so I've enjoyed every day.
And I think that what sort of like sees us, and this is what I hope comes across, and what we really want to come across, is that, you know, we are all a unit, right? And that we're all working towards the same thing. We might sort of raise the awareness in different ways, or we might tackle things in different ways, but ultimately our goal is all the same. So if we can sort of stick to what we're all good at, then ultimately we all come together to create something that is hopefully life-changing and supportive to different people, and have fun at the same time.
Absolutely. So we're a team. We've got and the thing about a team is that you bring different things to it. So yes, people yes. like Professor Gareth Evans, who's an absolute legend, and I will offer some clinical backup and some science. But you also need people who have got that lived experience, and that is so vital in the internet age. Information is out there, but how do you frame it that it actually means something, and people get a sense that there's a real person at the end of that message, and who's actually knows what it's like to go through preventative surgery, know what it's like to have a family history and lose close loved ones. And that is just absolutely, absolutely vital. And together we are just so much stronger. And it's just such a joy to work with people who are out there changing people's lives, keeping families together. There's nothing more important. And there's so much work still to be done, both in trying to make sure we find all those gene carriers, but then that's only half the battle. We need to support people through their decision making as well. I'm sure that will come into future podcasts, but thank you so much.
Julian, thank you so much, darling. And we will catch up with you again very, very soon. Keep up the amazing work that you are doing. And are you in any shows at the minute? Are you got anything? Because not only is he a master of genomics and changing the world, he's also a master of the theatre as well.
Well, I'm playing Hair Flick, would you believe, from A Low, A Low. That's my latest thing. So I seem to be getting typecast as an analytical psychopath. I don't quite know why, but it seems to be all my roles are pantomime villains. But you won't be that surprised to know I'm quite enjoying Hair Flick.
There is no surprise whatsoever, sweetheart. Listen, when's it on? Give it a plug.
That's in beginning of January. That's in King's Cliff, which is sort of Northampton, Peterborough type area. So super exciting. So yeah, reach out if you want to know more. But it will be about the 7th to the 9th of January.
Fantastic. Well, we'll make sure we give that another plug nearer to the time, my darling. Julian, go and keep up the amazing work. We've kept you away from clinic for far too long, I'm quite sure. Julian Barwell, ladies and gentlemen.